it's my pleasure to introduce Peter Bradley. He co-founded and directed Speakers Corner Trust, a charity which promotes freedom of expression, open debate and active citizenship in the UK. He's with us today to talk about his book, The Last Train, which discusses his family's fate in the Holocaust, following the thread from Germany to Latvia and to Britain. It was only after his father's death in 2004 when Peter was able to piece together the family's story and set out on the journey, both literally and figuratively, that forms the basis of this book. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Hello, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much. It's lovely to have you with us. And what a journey, I'm assuming, this book has been, doing all the research and putting it all together, finding out a lot of information.
Yes, I think it was 5 years in the making, but then I didn't actually set out to write a book. I started with a very simple ambition, which was to follow the route of the train which deported my grandparents from their home in Bamberg in Bavaria to Riga in Latvia. I don't know why I felt the need to do that, but that's what I set out to do. And oddly enough, it's one of the few bits of research that led me nowhere. I only, in the end, discovered the approximate route, which I did follow by train and then by bus, because many of the train tracks that were there in the 30s and 40s are no longer there. But in that research led me from one question to another, and the ultimate question, the penultimate question was, what happened to my grandparents, both in the years under the Nazis and then in particular when they reached Latvia? But almost more important than that question about what happened was, why did it happen? Why did their former friends, their neighbors, the people that they did business with, the people who shopped at their draper's store, why did they put them on that train? What awful accumulation of ideas and events led to that moment? Mm-hmm. So that really is what the book's about. And I've tried to, it takes me back 2,000 years to try to understand the origin of anti-Semitism. But then I've tried to explain its impact on Jewish communities in Germany and elsewhere through the prism of my own family, the history of which goes back, at least as far as we know, to the 15th century. So I've tried to use members of my family and what we know about them to illuminate this broader and longer history.
Mm. And I assume that's been very difficult to do, to try and understand why.
Well, on an emotional level, of course, it's almost impossible to understand how come people can be made or induced or encouraged to do these dreadful things. But I suppose, as people often say about these things, the first thing you do when you try to scapegoat other people is to dehumanize them. And that's what, to be frank, Christian culture did to Jews from the very early days, and certainly from the 4th century onwards, when the Christian church eventually triumphed over the synagogue to provide the dominant religion. You know, the depiction of Jews as Christ slayers, abominated by God, was a very, very powerful and strong part of the Christian message. And frankly, it's persisted in various incarnations, through beyond the Reformation into Protestant teachings, even after the Enlightenment, with the progressive thinking that gave rise to democratic institutions in the late 18th century. And it's still with us now. And that's why the Nazis found it relatively simple, or not simple, but straightforward to, amalgamate all these awful stereotypes about Jews and what they do and how evil they are, and induce people to follow them blindly. But but given that they already thought Jews were subhuman, it wasn't that much of a step to agree that you do to pests what you do to pests, you eliminate them.
Yeah, it is shocking that it still goes on today, anti-Semitism, isn't it?
It is, and but it's not just, I mean, I make the point, of course, my book is principally about my family and what happened to my family and why it happened. But I don't think we should forget that, you know, that there are other people who were victims of the Holocaust, all kinds of people, Jehovah's Witnesses, homosexuals, political radicals, Roma and Sinti, gay people, black people, and today, of course, Jews are not the only stereotypes. I guess the message from my book is, look, we need to be aware of what we're capable of. We need to be aware also of some of the strange beliefs and misbeliefs that we're prey to, and we need to take all the steps necessary to ensure that nothing happens, or, you know, again, as it did in the past. But having said that, you know, there have been genocides since the Second World War in just about every continent, including Europe, and we're witnessing now a dreadful, barbaric invasion of Ukraine, which again draws on anti-Semitic stereotypes, principally because the president of Ukraine is Jewish, but also because the propaganda that Putin sells to Russians is that they're in Ukraine for a moral purpose, which is to denazify a country which, frankly, is far less Nazi than the way the Russians are behaving currently.
Mm, yeah. So tell us a bit more about your father then, and what you found out about him, because you discovered by accident that your father was born with a different name.
That's right. When I was a small boy, I probably wasn't much more than 9 or 10, prying, as children of that age tend to, in a desk drawer when my parents were out, I found a document which had the name Fritz Brandes on it. And it was clearly my father's document, but I knew him as Fred Bradley. So I was confused, and this was something of a mystery for myself and my sister for many years, because certainly at that age, we didn't know what it meant, and we didn't know what questions to ask, and we didn't know whether we dared to ask about what clearly were, if not secrets, were things that my parents rather, you know, would rather not talk to us about. So it took quite some time before I discovered, my father's background as a Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany. He arrived here after 5 months in the concentration camp at Buchenwald, about which he never spoke. 5 awful months they must have been. He arrived here on the 10th of May, 1939. So he was one of the last of relatively few Jewish refugees who made it to this country. Of course, my grandparents were not so fortunate. They couldn't get a visa to this country, to the United States, or anyone else for that matter. And that's another lesson for us now, when, you know, we're faced with so many conflicts throughout the world, especially in Ukraine. But he was then arrested a year after he arrived here. A year to the day, he was arrested as an enemy alien and deported across the Atlantic to a camp in Canada, where he spent 2 years imprisoned with real Nazis and with German prisoners of war, before he was finally allowed to come back to Britain and enlist in the army.
Gosh.
So he had a pretty... And he wasn't, of course, the only Jewish refugee in those circumstances. But, you know, he survived it. He was, in the end, he was eternally grateful to this country for the opportunity to lead a, you know, relatively calm and peaceful life after the war, and to raise his family and enjoy the rights and freedoms that I think we rather too often take for granted in this country.
Mm. But amazing that he felt like that about Britain, having been made to leave previously.
Well, I think it was. And in direct contrast, the way he felt about America, because he'd originally intended to emigrate to America. He had relatives there, but they weren't interested. And when he was on a train coming from the camp he'd been held in Canada to the eastern seaboard, from which he was shipped back to London, the train stopped on American territory to take on water, and it was immediately surrounded by National Guardsmen, who were absolutely determined not to allow any of these German Jewish refugees to set foot on American soil. And from that moment on, you know, to his dying day, he was not America's greatest fan. But he, you know, he wanted to live a peaceful life. You know, so much of the promise of his youth had been snatched from him, his friendships, his opportunity to go to university and to fulfill his potential. And yet he'd been through such horrors. He'd lost his parents and many other, were 40 members of my family perished in the Holocaust. So it's not really that surprising. He didn't want to talk about these things.
No.
You know, and by talking about them, perhaps relive those awful experiences. He wanted to start again. He wanted to live an anonymous life. He didn't want to be singled out anymore. And he did appreciate everything that he thought that Britain stood for. I think he was very grateful to be able to live here. But he was also very forgiving. I mean, he used to return to Germany on an annual basis to meet up with his old school friends at school reunions. He didn't harbor a grudge. He always looked for the people's good sides. And sometimes I think to the extent that he overlooked some of the less good sides. But that was his character, and it was a credit to him.
Yeah, absolutely. So did he not talk to you about anything? Have you found all of this out through paperwork and things?
Well, very little. He did write, and this is actually what planted the seed in the first place. He did write a short history of his family, or our family, in his later years, I think in the 1990s perhaps. But it went into very little detail about the Nazi years. But it was fascinating to read the letter, the copy of the letter that he appended to this chronicle, the copy of the letter that he sent his parents about 10 days after he arrived in this country. And he describes in quite hilarious detail, actually, his first impressions of England and the English, and all the English appear as kind of characters from an Ealing comedy. And he says, rather touchingly, at the end of his letter, he said to his parents, don't worry that you can't speak English, because when you come here, you'll pick it up very quickly, because English people just love to talk to strangers. But, I mean, it was poignant, too, because, you know, they didn't come. They couldn't come. Mm. They were trapped. And along with hundreds of thousands of others who had tried to get out of Nazi Germany, they tried too late because they were German patriots. You know, they'd lived all their lives in Germany, as had generations before them. My grandfather was a veteran of the First World War. They thought that, you know, as unpleasant as the Nazis were, they'd outlive them. And of course, they were wrong. And by the time they were, you know, desperate to get out, most of the democracies had barred their doors, had closed the doors, including our country. And that's not exactly to its credit. I mean, I think people need to understand that even though we are very proud, for example, of the Kinder transport that saved the lives of about 10,000 children,
yes,
they were only allowed into this country on condition that their parents did not accompany them. And they were only given 2 years temporary visa. They had to be paid for their travel, their education, their subsistence in Britain by Jewish charities or benefactors. And then they were expected to return after the war, whenever that would be, to meet up again, to join up again with their parents. Well, very few were ever reunited with their parents. And we think, I think, you know, even in this day and age, we need to remember that we did good things. We did some not so good things too.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. I've always found it fascinating what people learn in schools, depending on the country that they're from, and also, I guess, maybe the type of education that they've got. I've interviewed many different people over the years and talked about the Second World War particularly, and really fascinating to what they learned at school, depending on the country that they were from. Something that maybe we don't always think about. You know, we know what we know, unless, you know, you've done a lot of research into it, which obviously you have. But people in different schools in different parts of the world can sometimes learn something very different.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that, for example, in Latvia and in many other of the countries that were occupied by the Nazis, there is a reluctance even now to accept that collaborators played a very a significant role in the implementation of the Holocaust in their countries. And I know for a country like Latvia that was occupied first by the Soviets, then by the Nazis, then by the Soviets again, and has always had a nervousness about its bigger neighbours. It's difficult to assume those histories, but I think it is necessary for all of us to be realistic about our past, because that's the best way that we can prepare for a better future. But it's also worth mentioning, if I may, that there were, just as there were countries and people who aided and abetted the Nazis, there were others that actually were rather more principled and indeed courageous. There's much to be said for the Bulgarians and the Finns for what they did to try to stave off the worst of the Nazi excesses. But the Danes in particular deserve commendation. They saved because simply they decided that was the kind of society they wanted to be. They did not discriminate against Danish Jews. They decided they were not going to cooperate with the Nazis when the Nazis decided to deport the Danish Jewish population to Theresienstadt, the camp there. They saved them. They hid them. And then they spirited them away over the water to neutral Sweden, where the vast majority of Danish Swedes survived. So just as, bad things can happen, people are capable of doing bad things, and we need to be aware of that, people are also capable of doing heroic, principled, courageous things. And those are, the examples we need to know about and to follow.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Well, it's been amazing to chat with you and have you on the programme. Peter Bradley, thank you very much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of the book, it's called The Last Train, A Family History of the Final Solution, and it's available on our website. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.